from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. For our New Year's show, we're revisiting a few of our favorite recent interviews. I'll start with a look at Clues Hall's 50th anniversary season.
I'll chat with clarinetist Sean Goodman about her new CD and also take a listen to it.
And I'll talk with author Allison Lynn about her newest novel. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. When it was built 5 decades ago, Clues Memorial Hall of Butler University was strikingly different from any other building on campus, and unique in our city. The season marks Clues' 50th anniversary, and Sharon Gamble invited Executive Director Elise Cushigan and Marketing Director Josh Lingenfelter to our studios to learn about the hall's history and the upcoming celebration.
So, Josh, I know that you're way too young to have been even dreamed of in 50 years ago when Clues Hall was opened. Of course, it was conceptualized. It took a while to find the architect to fine-tune what the hall was going to be, so it was conceptualized even more than 50 years ago. But as you understand it, what was the original intent of the hall? Was it intended to be of benefit to Butler University in some particular way?
I think it was really intended to be a benefit to the greater Indianapolis community. I mean, I think as you continue to look today, it still is designed to be something that welcomes in people from all across the state, in fact, even from all across the country, to experience a multitude of the arts, not just one particular type. Everything from orchestra to classical and pops to modern rock to Broadway shows to dance, modern dance and ballet. I think that was really the vision, something that any type of art could be displayed in and that the community at large would get the opportunity to see. And in fact, you know, when it was opened, that was really the discussion was this going to be a place that was going to be accessible to everybody?
Sure.
And even in those first reviews, that's the one thing that a lot of people had pointed out was this was really a place that was built for everybody. It didn't matter what you were really interested in. There was always going to be a performance that you could, you know, want to take your family to go see. And I think it ultimately became sort of a model, especially at this time, because it was a very unique facility. One, to be within a residential neighborhood.
Sure.
Another, to be on, you know, the campus of a private university. But then also to be right smack dab in the middle of the Midwest. It sort of opened up doors for touring, for people to look at Cincinnati and Indianapolis and Louisville and what ultimately became a Midwest touring circuit, because we had this facility that you could get to.
And this is a part of what you all do as a staff that we in the general public don't see. Is even now you're figuring out economies of scale, because an artist certainly is more efficient to book, more economical to book if he or she or they are traveling that circuit. They're going to the Aronoff Center, they're coming to Clues, they're going to Elliott Hall at Purdue. How far out is programming done these days? How far out are you?
Right now, we are actually negotiating for 14, 15 and having holds for 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on international artists, you'd need to be at least a year to 2 years out.
Sure. Is there still the big, what used to be called, I've just forgotten it, the big New York show where Performing Arts Hall staff go to?
Oh, APAP?
APAP,
yeah,
thank you.
The what is that?
Association
the
of Performing Arts, Arts Presenters.
Yeah.
Is it still called that?
Yeah.
Yes.
We don't actually... They still do that. We don't typically attend that. What we found over the years is that between doing the stuff that's a little bit more local to us, Arts Midwest, who we will attend their conference quite often,
mm-hmm.
And then there's the Southern Arts Conference and so on. But we found that really with the power of the internet today, We can find a lot about artists. And, you know, when we go to those types of events, you're really seeing what the agencies want you to see. These are the things that we want to put on tour, that we want to have come to Indianapolis.
Sure.
But that's never been the motive for Clues. It's never been to, we're just going to get the show that's already on tour. Our goal is always to find something that we didn't think was going to come in, that we didn't think was going to hit Indianapolis. And I think that over the last number of years, we've been very successful at doing those types of things, of either bringing in artists who weren't touring together and have them do one show, mm-hmm. just the two of them, or have it be one of five performances. A few years back, we had Bobby McFerrin, Chick Corea, and Jack DeJohnette. And it was an entirely improvised performance for 90 minutes. They didn't even talk to each other prior to the show. They walk out. Chick sits down onto the piano bench. It squeaks. Bobby makes the same noise, and they use that as the basis for their improvisation, and they take that and then run it for 90 minutes.
That's why people need to still go out and see things and not just experience them on the internet.
You would never.
That's a magic that happened that one time.
Mm-hmm. And you would never have seen it again.
Yeah,
but one time. And then the evening before had played at Carnegie Hall, completely different performance, and then the evening after that went to
L.A., the Disney Theater.
Yeah, Disney Theater, and it was one of three,
seven
performances.
But I think part of it is, too, is that we have very good relationships with artist managers and agents, and I annually make a trip to New York at a quiet time and sit down with them, and that's why in the 50th celebration that we were able to have a good working relationship and are bringing Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra with the total Marcellus family. And that is six separate contracts that were put together to make a very special evening.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
I'm laughing because it brought to mind a bizarro cartoon from a few years ago where a kid runs into the living room and says, "Daddy, Daddy, I've discovered another Marcellus."
And it was also very interesting on how we were going to build that as far as market it. And it was finally decided that when we do list everybody, it is in birth order.
Uh-huh.
So Ellis is first. So, but those are those special arrangements. Yes, conferences are good. Internet
sure.
is good. But it's also the one-on-one relationships that over the years, Josh and I both have had, along with other staff members, relationships with managers that have gotten us unique performances.
And you have a very long tenured staff. Actually, Clues Hall has had, you can count on one hand the number of executive directors, and I think you probably hold the record for longest tenured. How long have you been at Clues?
18 years.
18 years. And Josh, you are close to 15 years.
Close to 15, with 11 of those being full-time. Four of those were whenever I was a student, and I started off as a volunteer and then went all the way up the ladder.
Up the chain,
Elise guiding me from the time I was a freshman in college.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For better or for worse.
So let's talk about that for a minute. So when Clues Hall opened, I don't remember the opening of Clues Hall, but just from reading and from observing the art scene in the last few decades, the Murat was not being used the way it is now. There were no truck and bus shows at the Murat. I know the Indianapolis Opera used it as its home base for a while back in the day. Certainly the DeHaan Fine Arts Center, which didn't open until the mid-90s on the University of Indianapolis campus, did not exist. So what was, in those earlier days, was Clues Hall unique? Was there any other hall in Indianapolis that was being booked in the same way?
Not in 1963. There had been in the 50s. I mean, we all know about Indiana Avenue and all that. And there was, there's a book on the history of theaters in Indianapolis that has a very rich history. But in 63, no. It was, the Indianapolis Symphony needed a home. And that was one of the reasons, you know, for its design was to be a symphony hall,
mm-hmm.
in addition to grand opera and in addition to dance.
And you toss that off so casually, but those are three different sets of specifications. So it's really quite miraculous that halls at all, and Clues Hall in particular, can be built to accommodate, you know, you need a different kind of floor for dance, you need a pit, you need fly space. A hall can't be all things to all people, but Clues comes pretty close.
But that's why Clues has been written up in so many architectural magazines. That's why the Today Show was airing from Clues, the opening weekend, and the big write-up in the New York Times, is its unique design and its ability to be a hall for all the performing arts. It was also compared a great deal at the same time with Lincoln Center, which was also being built. So there was discussions on that type of thing. So
not least because of the contemporary architecture in settings in both places with a good deal more traditional architecture around it.
It was also, too, reducing size for audience. We know about Elliott Hall at 5,000 seats and the IU Auditorium at 3,500 seats. So here you've got a 2,000-seat hall, and that is it was another major change in the design of theaters at that time.
Have you ever had... not pressure, but suggestions that the seating be changed from the, is it called European-style seating? Continental seating with the nice wide rows so you can actually walk to your seat if other people in your row are already seated. Does anybody ever push at
we
could accommodate more people and sell more tickets if there were less leg room?
Actually, you cannot. It's not accommodation of more seats. It's we did look at it. If you recall, we just completed a $2 million restoration of the auditorium, and we looked at what can you do, and it's actually the exiting way of exits, you know, because you go out the side doors,
right?
And so the continental seating is remaining.
Good.
And so they are brand new restored seats and new seats in the theater.
Now, we've seen a lot of venues. I mean, Elise and I and Karen Steele, our director of operations, tend to look at what other venues do and how their seating is and try to take a look at the industry and see where it's going. And most people, whenever they do those renovations or those restorations, look at how can they increase their capacities.
Right.
The only thing I think that we ever discussed was we may want to make some adjustments that may end up decreasing capacity. Mm. We have never really had a discussion to say, let's get more seats in here, because the first thing that we know is going to happen is that you're going to lose leg room. You're going to lose space. You're going to lose comfortability.
Yeah.
And we do have a lot of folks who come to Clues who enjoy coming to see shows at Clues because we haven't done that. We haven't said we could kind of sneak in 200 more seats here.
We can sardine a few more people, like the
airlines.
Forget
a few more people in here. Yeah, that's really not been something that we're really. We like to sit in those seats too.
On behalf of all of our listeners, thank you.
Also, you don't want to sell partial vision seats,
right?
You know,
good point.
So we take a deal of time putting this mystical set on stage, and we have sat in every single seat to see. Can I see it or not?
Right.
And so that's very important to us, too.
Hey, let's talk about the official big anniversary weekend. You have an open house on October 20th, and among other things, what sounds like a pretty dramatic piece of art, collection of art, help me here, will be revealed.
We're calling it a mosaic, really. And what we did, we have a program called Art at Clues that highlights Hoosier artists all throughout the season.
Right.
So that, you know, Monday through Friday from our normal business hours, you know, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., you could come in and you can view artwork from a local artist. And this was something that was started by Samantha Cross a number of years ago that was continued with James Kramer, our community relations manager. And we looked to those artists and to other artists across the state to look at what we were sort of putting together for the 50th as reflecting on the past, inhabiting the present, and envisioning the future, or imagining the future, something along those lines.
Sure.
Past, present, and future. And we got 36 artists to create 50 different pieces of artwork.
Wow.
Each of those are approximately 4 feet wide by 4 feet high. And they are all hung on the main wall as you come inside Clues in the main lobby.
Wow.
So it's about a three-story installation. And it's a very interesting piece to look at because it sort of has a number of artists' different representations of Clues or of Indianapolis or of just even some of, I think, are just even of themselves over the course of 50 years.
Wow.
And the wonderful thing, too, is there's a quilt. There are some glass mobiles, there are oils, there are acrylics, there's photographs. So it's a multimedia mosaic in addition to being, you know, 50 different pieces. It's different mediums.
Sharon Gamble with Clues Memorial Hall's Executive Director Elise Cushigan and Marketing Director Josh Lingenfelter. Learn about the season, including Clues Presents, Clues Conversations, Clues Off-Center, Art at Clues, Clues for Kids, and much, much more Clues at cluesHall.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. When people think of jazz clarinetist, Goodman is often the first name people think of. And though Benny Goodman is certainly a traditional favorite, there's another Goodman in town, so to speak. Jazz clarinetist Sean Goodman, no relation, has a new CD out with her playing some classic tunes with pianist Gary Walters. Travis DiNicola had Sean in to take a listen to her CD.
Sean, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks.
So, congratulations on your new and first CD, which is just excellent.
Thank you.
Let's start with the title here, Not Benny's Goodman. It's a fun title.
Yeah. So, well, you know, Benny Goodman, the famous swing clarinetist, big band and everything. So, you know, my last name's Goodman, and it's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Benny Goodman, Sean Goodman, not Benny's Goodman. And I try to pay, you know, respects to him in a way, and yet go in a more modern direction.
Sure. And no relation.
No. I wish.
It was funny. I was listening to this CD the other night. In fact, I was just telling you my dad was in the car, and he's like, well, who is that? I said, Sean Goodman. He's like, any relation to Benny Goodman? Like,
yeah, maybe if people think that, maybe they'll want to buy the album.
There we go. So, Not Benny's Goodman. And it is, it's a great album. And so it's you and then also Gary Walters on piano, just the two of you throughout, which is just a really lovely, clean sound. Tell me how this CD came about.
Well, Gary and I started playing together, I think about 2010, when I was actually working on my master's in classical clarinet performance at Butler University.
Okay.
And so Gary teaches jazz piano there. Gary's just amazing. I mean, if Gary's got a solo album out, too, that is just wonderful. People should check that out. But Gary and I just started getting together once a week and kind of jamming and playing some stuff and realized we kind of had, you know, a nice sound and something that people might, you know, like to listen to. So, you know, we started doing some gigs and just decided finally to just, you know, lay down some tracks. So we went to Airtime Studios down in Bloomington.
Okay.
A guy there, Chip Reardon, he did a great job really getting, you know, a real intimate sound out of the clarinet that's hard to get sometimes. But he mic'd it really well, and we went down there 2 days in March and recorded all the tunes, picked our favorites, and there's the album.
So the first number on here is actually, as I was saying to you earlier before we went on the air, Loverman's my favorite on the whole CD. I just really enjoy the interaction between you and Gary on this. And you said that it almost didn't end up on the CD.
Right. Yeah, I, you know, there's a lot of good tracks on there, but, and I'm always going to be my most critical, but I thought, well, it's not great, you know, I wasn't even going to put it on there. And then Gary said, no, you know, it grooves, you know, people like that. It's got a nice feel. We play well together, you know, and I said, okay. So I kind of listened to him again and I was trying to figure out what song to make the first one. And he said, you should make Loverman the first one. And I thought, okay, so I made it the first one, and then after I had sent it off to get it reproduced, I thought, I shouldn't have put that on there. I shouldn't have made it the first one, and I've heard from more than one person, actually, that that's one of their favorites, so thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a little bit more of a listen to Loverman on the CD Not Benny's Goodman, Sean Goodman with Gary Walters. And we're back, and this is Travis DiNicola with jazz clarinetist Sean Goodman talking about her new CD. We were just listening to the first track on it. What was your favorite piece on this, Sean, when you were working on this, or as you go back to it now, or you're just really glad you included it on the CD?
I'm really glad that I included Infant Eyes on there.
Yeah, tell me about this song.
Well, it's a song by Wayne Shorter. Wayne Shorter's always been one of my very favorite saxophonists. And matter of fact, Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock did an amazing duo collaboration that has inspired me. One of the many duos that's inspired me to play in the duo collaboration. But Wayne Shorter made the tune Infant Eyes. I wasn't really very familiar with it, and then Gary actually introduced me to the tune in the first place. And it's just the chords, and it's slow, beautiful. The melody just flows, and I think on the clarinet, it just fits really nicely, in that register. Mm-hmm. Gary plays the heck out of it.
Yeah, he does.
I'm just so lucky that he is even willing to play with me, because I feel like he just makes me sound so good,
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is. So that's probably my favorite tune.
Well, let's take a little bit more of a listen to Infant Eyes. With Sean Goodman, jazz clarinetist. We're just listening to Infant Eyes off of her new CD. Sean, you've got a concert coming up November 10th.
Yes.
And that's and you and Gary, right?
Actually, this one's going to be with my quartet.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So this will be Manny De La Rosa will be playing piano. Let's see, John Crable will be playing drum set, and Joe Deal will be playing bass.
Nice. Joe's awesome on
bass.
Yeah, he is. So tell me about this concert. It's part of the Second Sunday concerts?
Yes, at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation.
Okay.
And I play there in a small chamber ensemble a few times a month, but this is a special event that they do. Second Sunday of every month, they bring in a featured group. They have a youth orchestra coming in. They've got a few choirs coming in. I know Icarus played there last year. It's a big deal that they do, but they've invited me to bring in a quartet on Sunday, November 10th. It's at 2:00.
Yeah, 2 p.m. and it's a free concert.
Yes, and all ages. It's a wonderful opportunity. There aren't many opportunities for children, mm-hmm. especially people, you know, anybody under 21 to go and hear live jazz. So this is one of those few opportunities that I hope everybody takes advantage of.
Excellent. And again, this is at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation up on 6501 North Meridian Street. Sean, you're also involved with the Symphonic Youth Orchestra. Tell me a bit about that.
Yes, the Symphonic Youth Orchestra of Greater Indianapolis. That's a summer youth orchestra program that I co-founded with my husband, Steve Goodman, who's a violinist and a music educator here in town. Basically, we run Monday and Thursday evenings through June and the first part of July. We work with musicians from the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra mm-hmm. and college professors from all around the state. The past 4 years now, I think, we've had Time for Three come in and work with the kids.
They're just awesome.
Oh, mm-hmm. my gosh. Amazing. It's one of those things that, you know, really inspires the kids. They see people not too much older than them really yeah. jamming and just loving what they do and doing it well. And I know it's inspired a lot of our kids. But basically, we perform real orchestral literature.
Okay.
And they rehearse and they do a couple performances. We typically do one at the Arts Garden and one at Cathedral High School in their auditorium there. So that's been a really awesome thing, and we will be going into our seventh summer season.
Wow, that's
this
great.
Summer, yeah.
Now, if people want to get more information about the Symphonic Youth Orchestra of Greater Indianapolis, of course, they can go to the website.
Absolutely. It's www.syogi.org.
S-Y-O-G-I.
Yes.
So it's like S-Yogi.
Yeah, some people say that. Yeah, Symphonic cool. Youth Orchestra, Greater Indianapolis.
Very cool.
We just leave out the of.
Nice. Hey, so we're going to wrap this up listening to one of the other tracks on here, Tenderly. Tell me a bit about this one.
I always wanted to play this tune ever since I heard Sarah Vaughan sing it.
Mm-hmm.
She has, in my opinion, the most amazing voice as a jazz vocalist. She really takes her voice and turns it into an instrument. And the flexibility that she has in her timbre really, for me, connects to the clarinet. And so I really hear her singing it in my mind as I'm playing it. And so
nice.
I hope that people hear it
yeah.
As a sung piece as well.
Sean, where can we get your CD? How do we get a copy of this?
You can find my CD on iTunes.
Okay.
You can go on Amazon. You can go to my website, which is seangoodmanjazz.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't find it there, come to my concert and you can buy one. I'll even sign it.
Cool. All right. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of Tenderly off your new CD. Sean, thanks so much for coming into
Thank
our
you,
the
Matter.
Travis DiNicola with clarinetist Sean Goodman. Her new CD is titled Not Benny's Goodman and can be found at CD Baby. More information is at seangoodmanjazz.com, and Sean is spelled S-H-A-W-N, so seangoodmanjazz.com.
Hey, Travis, I feel like our theme music for today's calendar should be Talking About a Resolution.
That's right. Happy New Year, Sharon.
Happy New Year to you. It's 2014. You know, I'm sorry to say this, but I often make the same resolution because it's fresh every year, and that is I resolve to go out and see more shows, see more art.
See more local productions.
Exactly. I'm glad to know we're on the same page.
Absolutely.
For our calendar we call
What'll we do in 2014?
In 2014.
Well, here's an easy one for you. Phoenix Theater is opening the play Tribes. That's opening on January 9th, running through February 9th. And it's kind of a, well, you know, Phoenix Theater. I mean, it always just a little quirky, always a little different. And this one is dealing with a very eccentric English family that has its own little empire. In fact, it has private languages and all types of other strange stuff. Follows the story of a boy named Billy, who's actually deaf, and his girlfriend Sylvia, and it should be a really interesting play. And again, this is called Tribes and taking place at the Phoenix Theater.
And I know grown men who wept when they read that script, so.
Goodness.
Sure to be a moving production, so. Hey, for a whole different kind of entertainment, the IMA Winter Nights film series in the Toby begins this week with The Thin Man. That's very stylish.
Love that show.
I know, light 1934 show. Sipping martinis like water and trading one-liners like a game of hot potato, Nick and Nora Charles will have you rolling in the aisle in this lighthearted whodunit. That is this Friday, January 3rd. And, of course, you can buy something to eat and drink and enjoy the evening there.
Hey, the cabaret at the Columbia Club has just announced their 2014 winter and spring season, which includes some great highlights, including Smash Diva Megan Hilty and Broadway sweetheart Laura Benanti. And let's see, Meow Meow is coming back by popular demand.
Yay!
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Tierney Sutton, Stephanie Block. So you can subscribe or get individual tickets when you go to thecabaret.org to get all the information about their 2014 season.
Hey, we know that you occasionally tune to other radio stations and listen to music elsewhere. So you probably know about Lillian Madeline, who are a sister duo from Indianapolis, singer-songwriters, and they're joining the ISO on January 23rd for Happy Hour at the Symphony on a program with Time for Three and the ISO, of course.
It's a great
and
show.
Many, many more. Exactly. Again, that's coming up on January 23rd at the Hilbert Circle Theater.
Very good. Well, Sharon, that's all the time we have right now, but we will be back next week with more things to do on the calendar we call
What'll We Do? Happy New Year!
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
With dark humor, Allison Lynn's new novel, The Exiles, explores what we do when the path of our lives change on both a personal and national level. The Butler University professor began her conversation with Sharon Gamble with a reading from the novel describing the moment her protagonist, Emily, realizes that her career is all wrong.
Security, peace of mind, was that so much to ask? Emily felt the weight of her wants as she and Nate and Trevor settled into their suite. They couldn't afford this room. They couldn't even afford the tax on it. Sure, she'd once stayed in Lux hotels frequently for work. She traveled regularly to Chicago, L.A., Miami, Denver. She stayed in rooms stocked with complimentary champagne and pillow-top mattresses, all on the company's Amex. Those overnight trips had felt like fractures in time, as if she'd stepped through a portal into a world where she was herself, only glossier. The trips were one of the few things she truly missed about her career. Recently, she'd also begun to miss the simple act of being skilled at something. Though she'd never planned to be in experiential advertising, she fell into the job after declining grad school, it turned out she was good at the work, often great. For a time, she even convinced herself it was worthwhile, until it wasn't. It fell apart in a single moment. She'd been perched on the edge of her creative director's desk, leading the team through her concept for her client's new potato chip, a toasted canola oil version of their market leader. The director's office was large but cramped, filled with a menagerie of blow-up toys, rubber monsters, movie posters, presidential bobbleheads, an electronic keyboard, and the requisite magic eight ball. Despite the distractions, the team appeared entirely focused on Emily. Her concept involved positioning the new chip as a niche product, rolled out slowly, first in only the top five markets, mimicking the typical rollout of a gourmet offering, with interactive street booths manned by actual chefs who'd hand out samples and suggest, seriously, beer and soda pairings. Once they'd solidified those elite markets, they'd launch nationally with a sponsored chip dip competition, revealing the winners in a six-part commercial series, TV spots with an ongoing narrative. At the same time, they'd roll out commercials for the commercials' meta ads. The idea was cheeky, especially for a low-market national company, a company that sold snack foods available primarily at mini-marts. The idea mocked the current trend towards small-batch gourmet goods, even as it lured in that exact consumer demographic. Emily's concept was both novel and, could it be, brilliant. Brilliant not merely in her own eyes, she could sense that the rest of the five-person team felt it as well. While she spoke, they remained hushed but jittery, as if carbonated. Other snack food brands had done almost nothing in the experiential realm. Nobody had even thought small, and here was Emily thinking big. As her team's excitement grew, Emily, too, turned giddy. She'd leapt from a ledge with this idea, and she was flying. Nina Searle, the creative director, leaned in toward Emily, grinning. "We'll present it as is Friday," she said. "Tom Bascom's group can produce the street booths," said Aaron Nielsen, the man who made things happen. "Shit, Emily, we could fast-track it." "Maybe not Bascom this time," said Nina. The room hummed. They'd nail this account. They'd make inconceivable amounts of money for the conglomerate that owned the toasted chips. They'd make money for the umbrella corporation that held the strings of their own ad agency. They'd sign other emerging food accounts. They'd soar for a while, at least. And who in this industry cared about the long term anyway? "So no Bascom. Fine, I'll get Cal Tomlin," Aaron said. "I owe Tomlin a favor. He'll love us for this. Everyone wins." "Oh, Emily, the commercials for the commercials," Nina flipped through the account memo. "Awesome." "Oh, Emily," to use a figure of speech from Nate's playbook, Emily had hit one out of the park. "We'll present it as is." Even Maggie Yen, the group's assistant, was caught up in the thrill, nodding in quick bursts, bouncing on the balls of her feet. "Oh, Emily." Emily was on a high, her chest inflating with the helium of a job spectacularly done. It was inebriating, even more so than the beta blockers she'd taken to calm her pre-meeting nerves, even more so than the four cups of coffee she'd drunk in gulps that morning. She wanted to remember this moment. "Oh, Emily." She was buoyant, aloft. And then, "Wait, what's that?" From her new vantage point, Emily understood something that she somehow hadn't fully grasped before. It was a potato chip. So much glorious thought, all to promote a potato chip.
I had to bite my tongue to not laugh out loud at some of this, because it's just such a beautiful picture of capitalism in some ways. And I love that this novel is on so many different levels a story of exiling yourself, the characters exiling themselves from what used to be that glossy world that they wanted.
Right.
It's like their kids with their face pressed against the plate glass windows of, you know, the candy store. And all of a sudden, it's poof, it's gone. Their lives are anew.
And I think these are characters, to me at least, who never thought they'd be the ones pressed with their face against the door. I think they always assumed they would break in and they would be fully inhabiting that really glossy and very expensive life, and suddenly it proves to them too hard to attain. And so the book really launches with them trying to figure out, well, if we can't have that, then what now?
Yeah, who are we now? It's also a really page-turning, compelling story about discovery set on a Columbus Day weekend. No, mm-hmm. no coincidence, I suspect.
Exactly.
You were living in New York at the conception of this novel, I assume. How did these characters come to you? Where did this story come to you?
I was living in New York for almost the entire process of writing the book. We moved to Indiana as I was finishing sort of the final couple of drafts. I'm not a fast writer, so the book was completed over many, many years. And I started it when I was in my mid-30s. And at the time, even though the book is about characters who get priced out of New York and leave to go somewhere else, having never thought they'd leave New York, I was still guilty of what they were feeling at the start. I never thought I'd leave New York. I would just write about characters who left. And then I found myself, as I was finishing the book, very much in their shoes. It very much started, but it's turned out to be a happy ending. So
it's like lucid dreaming, but you're putting it on paper.
Exactly. Well, in my next book, I'm going to be a lottery winner. And
okay,
we'll
excellent.
If that comes true. But I was living in New York and watching. I don't base my characters on anyone specific I know or specifically on myself, but on ideas or issues that I see my sort of contemporaries and friends dealing with that weigh on my mind. And as I was in my mid-30s, I was seeing a lot of friends of mine having to reckon with where their life had ended up. The sense of, it now seems to me so young, mid-30s, now that I'm slightly out of my 30s. But there's this sense when you're in your 20s of anything can happen. Your life can go in any direction. And there's an excitement to that. And then I was watching friends of mine hit their mid-30s and think, well, now their life couldn't go in any direction. And they hadn't necessarily ended up in the roles they wanted. And the first character who came to me, or the first two, were the book's main characters are a couple, Nate and Emily. And Nate came to me first along with his father, who in the book is a very successful, well-known architect. And this is based on watching the men I knew who felt very overshadowed by their fathers. And this is obviously not all men. These are the men I was interested in at the time, friends of mine, who were very successful in their own rights by many measures, yet they hadn't accomplished what their fathers had accomplished, and they were trying to live up to that and feeling like failures when they shouldn't have been, or feeling as if they were left behind. And Nate, in the book's way of dealing with this, because his father is a very visible presence, has been to not try to live up to him, to absent himself from his father's life, which is easy because his father is not the nicest man, and to try and escape the shadow of his past. And it turns out that that's not quite as easy as he thought it would be. And then Emily was really based on, well, the men I knew were trying to live up to these set standards that history and their fathers had set for them. The women my age, I was seeing, we'd been told, well, you can do anything. There's no need to live up to anything. And that's its own sort of pressure. And so Emily is a character who all of a sudden, as I just read, the job in advertising proved unfulfilling, so she thinks, well, we'll do something else, but what else? Sort of the sky's the limit, and she finds she can't do anything. So in the book, while Nate is very focused on his past, she's very much focused and panicked about the future.
I love the scenes in which she brainstorms, well, I could be an artisanal cheesemaker. I could do this. I could invent that. And yet nothing really seems to stick. She's kind of rudderless and rootless.
And those were a lot of fun to write. I kept hoping one of them might stick because they all sounded like a lot. I have my own dreams of being an artisanal cheesemaker, and I know I could never do it for the same reasons I think she could never do it.
It might be easier in Indianapolis than it was in New York City, though.
Well, this has occurred to me. It may be in my future. In my head, as she was dreaming all of these things up, I thought, well, what somebody really needs for any of these ideas is a garage, which you never have in New York, to have your little workshop. And suddenly I live somewhere where I have a garage.
I'm going to get you and your husband, the novelist Michael Daly, in the same room to have this conversation about you never expected to live in the middle of the country, especially in Indianapolis, and your insights are an interesting complement to one another's on that, as I'm sure you know because you have had this conversation many times. What the heck are we doing to ourselves, right?
Well, that's what also largely paralleled my book, where the couple in the book is moving from New York to Newport, Rhode Island, having not really chosen Newport, but it's where the job for Nate arose, and so they went. And we had, while living in New York, much like the characters, the great wealth of New York started looming over us, and we are two writers, and probably were crazy to live in Manhattan for so long. And so we sort of daydreamed a little bit about where would we go, but hadn't really thought about leaving. And then this job at Butler University came up, and having never considered living in Indianapolis or Indiana or even really the Midwest, the job was really intriguing, and we came. And one of the things that the characters in the book talk about, or Emily thinks at a moment because she's a little bit down on suddenly ending up on Newport, is that there's something really enticing about the random chance of it, about going somewhere you haven't quite chosen. And that actually proved to be really exciting in the end as we were packing up in New York, and I thought, I don't know what I'll find. And it's ended up well.
The book has as its catalyst, an emotional as well as financial catalyst, the fact that it's set in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It's not immediately post 9/11, but I have the sense through the character of Emily that I understand a little bit more what it was like to have lived in New York City in the few years after 9/11, because everything shifted. The earth shifted
right
underfoot.
It was a strange time, and I specifically chose not to write the book in the year or two directly after 9/11. I think I'm not really ready to capture that yet. It was a very, very strange time. And there was a sense right afterwards that the world and the city would never be the same, that this was, and I mean, it tremendously was life-altering. But by 2004, the city had really resumed its rhythms in both a good and a bad way. The economy was on an upswing, which was important for it's a book that's very much about economic precariousness, and it's easy at times of recession to say, oh, people struggle. But I really wanted to show the ways people struggle and unexpected people struggle, even during good times. And so that was important to me. So the city was taking off again, but also people were starting to, I mean, I hate to say this, it's the wrong word. I was going to say people were starting to forget 9/11. But it was fading into the background. And I think all of those years of thinking, well, the world is never going to be the same, in a nice way, I mean, the United States triumphed, and New York triumphed, and we got back, and Wall Street came back, and we went back to work. But then for people like Nate and Emily, who are desperate for a change, to find that their life is the same as it was before, it was also an interesting time for me to be looking at their lives. What do you do when you were hoping the world itself would offer you change, and it hasn't?
And part of the response to this new normal is that they kind of lose one another.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, you mentioned that the title being The Exiles, which works on a number of levels. They're very much exiles from New York, as only people, I think, in New York can imagine it who haven't lived elsewhere. There's this terror of going elsewhere, and they feel as if they've been sent financially somewhere else.
To the gulag.
But they also are exiled from each other during the book because they have secrets that they're keeping from each other. And largely to protect the other. I do feel that they're, even when they're apart and their relationship is suffering a bit during the book, they're very much in love, but they sort of lose each other and become, it's easy to think in water imagery for me because the book is set in Newport, Rhode Island, but they sort of become separate islands. And that was interesting for me. Also, two characters who are together, it's just them and their 10-month-old for most of the book on this journey. And physically, they're together for most of it, but emotionally, they're very separate.
Sharon Gamble with writer and Butler University professor Allison Lynn, who happens to be married to writer and Butler University professor Michael Daly. Allison's new novel is called The Exile. Learn more about Allison and The Exiles at AllisonLynnBooks.com. That's Allison, A-L-L-I-S-O-N, Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Books.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. And be prepared for a whole new year of interviews coming your way.
Plus a whole new year of that arts calendar that we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.